This is Howard Braun and Flo Joseph for the National Council of Jewish Women. We're going to interview William Bill Stark, S-T-A-R-K, at 5048 Fifth Avenue, Pittsburgh, on November 25. The 25th. Thank you. 1991. Bill, I'm going to ask you a very general question. And that is, I'd like to hear the beginning, essentially about your family, where you were from, when, where you were from, their names, your brothers and sisters. Who are you from the beginning? And that's a good way to start. You're on.
It's a question. I was born in New York City because both of my parents lived there at that time. They were quite active in the Jewish socialist, democratic socialist movement. My mother marched with Margaret Sanger, for instance, in 1916. Favor of women's rights, the right to vote, which didn't exist then. And my mother was an organizer for the Network Makers Union, and my father at that time was working for the International Women's Garment Workers Union. Eventually was invited to come to Pittsburgh to manage a rather large men's clothing store at the corner of 5th and Smithfield, where Mellon Bank now sits. The store had 120 employees, including 10 tailors. It was quite an establishment. He eventually left that job because he didn't like the pay practices and the labor practices of his national company. He went out to Braddock in 1917. Went to work for Abe Oringer for 6 weeks and they earned their own furniture company. He was so successful as a salesman that the other salesman begged Mr. Oringer to ask him to leave. So he retired, went across the street and opened a man's clothing store, which was extant until 1924. I had two brothers and a sister. School, got out starting in 1923, the old third board school, then went to the fourth board school, and in 1926 we moved to Swissville. So I went to Hawkins Public School, was first graduating class out of Dixon Junior High. I had one Jewish classmate in that whole experience. Touch Gene Lippman and Sally White and Miss Klein. It was casual. These were not classmates, so that there was no real relationship. Sister's name was Leah.
Older or younger?
Older. She was the oldest. In 1916. And she graduated from the University of Pittsburgh and married Grace B. Freelander. Eventually moved to Baltimore, where she became quite an important figure in the Baltimore community as the campaign manager for the then mayor, Bill Schaefer, now governor. She was very active in politics and was responsible for picking Barbara Mikulski to become the congressman from her district and now the senator. At her funeral last year, Senator Sarbanes, Governor Schaefer, Barbara McCliskey, and dozens of judges and other political figures that she had put into office responded rather favorably to her contributions. She has two sons, one practicing law in Baltimore and one writing the speeches for the governor of Maryland. So that was quite a successful career that she has.
Yeah, that's lovely. A little bit more about your parents. Where were they from?
My mother came from Romania, bringing two younger sisters 38 days on a boat out of Hamburg. We did do an interview on her many years ago. By myself, I have a book, I think, or see
yes.
Sure that she says. And if you go back and read that, it's a fascinating story about my mother, because every time you ask seven or eight people a question, you would get seven answers identical from the other people, and my mother's was always different. My mother was a fantastic, radical woman who wouldn't believe in free love and insisted on marriage and the family being the important aspects of survival. And she was a fantastic listener, great with males.
How old was she when she came from Romania?
She would have come at the age of born in 1894. She would have come at the age of 13, bringing two younger sisters. Her mother died in Europe, and that was always a source of deep pain for her. The father died in this country. Of course, being Romanian and her father being a grain dealer, she had a relatively comfortable childhood, although it only consisted of 3 years of schooling. She continued to be a voracious reader on a very, very, very slow level, but always interested in encouraging young people.
What about your father?
My father came from Galicia, born in 1893. He came when he was 13 and immediately got a job and had a distinguished career on the east side of New York, being a real street person. He had 1 year of schooling in Europe and had outread anybody I ever knew in my life, including my Harvard Law School professors. When he died, there were five books on the night table that he would read simultaneously. A voracious reader.
Did he know Dubinsky?
I'm sorry?
Did he know Dubinsky?
Extremely well. Both of them knew Dubinsky extremely well. These were the people that they were born and raised with. And if you saw the movie Reds,
sure.
John Reed went off to communist Russia, and he was part of that group. But my parents were never part of anything but the Democratic Socialist movement. My dad was in on the founding of the Jewish Labor Committee in 1934, attempting to save some of the leading Democratic Socialist labor leaders of Europe before Hitler could annihilate them. And so their whole life was quite interesting. My father was a phenomenal public speaker. I could see him standing on a soapbox at Flowers Avenue and 2nd Avenue down in Hazelwood on a Saturday night. And he just became a great, great speaker. My father could read and write and simultaneously translate 9 different languages, so that he was most active in reading the 14 weekly and daily German newspapers that were published in Pittsburgh in the 30s. Old friends with George Hess, the owner of Oswald and Hess, the largest meat packing company in Pittsburgh, and he would sit and read those papers, so that in 1936, reading these German papers while he simultaneously was reading the Jewish Daily Forward, which at that time was anywhere from 4 to 6 weeks ahead of the New York Times
on, this kind of
on what was going on in the world,
he was able to persuade Leo Lehman and Lewis Kaplan, who are his close friends, that they should convene a group of prominent Pittsburghers to let him explain what was going on, what Hitler was doing. And this meeting was held at the Fort Pitt Hotel in 1936. And my father stood up and read the German newspaper and the Jewish Daily Forward simultaneously or consecutively for this group of people, including Edgar Kaufman and Mr. Falk, and at that time the moneyed people of Pittsburgh. And that was the beginning of the United Jewish Fund. My dad came home that day.
Were you at the meeting by the chance?
Let me finish. In 1936, I was still in school. My dad came home that day, and he said, well, today they started the United Jewish Federation, and we raised $105,000 at that lunch. So the United Jewish Federation now goes along being strictly a fundraising arm, because at that time we had the Federation of Jewish Philanthropies, which had started in 1912, and they merged those two organizations in 1955. And that was a very difficult merger involving really difficult personalities, because you had two contending groups who didn't believe each the other was capable of understanding their philosophical difference. So there was the beginning of the United Jewish Federation as we know it today. Of course, the great compromiser became the first president of that jointure, and that was Louis Reisenstein. On one side you had then Edgar Kaufman and Mr. Falk and Mr. Kaplan. Actually, they were the people who were being intermediaries, but strongly urging the continuation of the United Jewish Fund in the fundraising aspects, alongside the social worker types involved with the Federation. Mr. Ludwig Bernstein, at that time the executive director, the place was on 15th Fernando Street. They did some good things, I'm sure, but this merger was inexorable. There was just no reason for having these two separate organizations. In 1938, for instance, my sister was contracted by Dr. Maurice Taylor, who succeeded Dr. Bernstein. And Taylor had my sister do the first demographic analysis of the Jewish community of Pittsburgh, which at that time, you may not know, concentrated in Squirrelville and East Liberty, Stanton Heights, and maybe some remnants on the Hill District. So you didn't have to go far to find where they were living. 1936, you might have had one, I don't remember, when Mr. Posner moved to Fox Chapel or Mr. Edgar Kaufman moved to Fox Chapel, but they would have been the only two Jews out there, so all the other Jews were in this city by itself. So this demographic survey in 1938 lasted long enough that we didn't do it again at the Federation until at least the 70s, and then of course the third one has now been done in the 80s. So that this is the history of the Federation's analysis of the demographic character of our city. Now the Jewish Family and Children's Service in 1991 was concerned about doing another study of where the need pockets are. That was probably one of the questions my sister was not asked to concern herself with, because what they were hoping to do was find the Jews that really needed succor. Of course, subsequent to that, you found the Rechamanim Society, which still has remnants in the form of a nice endowment fund the Jewish Family and Children's Service has access to. Lechemanim's purpose was to pass out food, the real direct charity that the Jewish social workers tell us is anathema to them today.
Yes.
But that was a changing of the times.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned your parents' origination, at least in America, in New York City, and then your father coming here. for that job to finish up in New York City.
Let me carry you forward to Pittsburgh, because what happened in New York City, of course, they were excited, because if you may not know this, but the socialists on the east side elected two people to the New York State Assembly.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, I've now recently discovered that in Pittsburgh in 1912 and 1913 and 15 and 16, there were socialists elected in Wall and in Trafford and in East Pittsburgh. And then, of course, the interesting thing about the socialist movement in Pittsburgh was that it was basically constructed along lines of national origin. The Finns had a group, and the Galicianers had a group, and they were all separate enclaves. There was a huge number of socialists in the trade union movement out at Westinghouse.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, if you remember, the Galicianers dominated the population among the Jews in Braddock, while the Hungarians dominated in McKeesport.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was a basic conflict. I came across a piece of material in the last couple of weeks that I will share with you, written in 1921, when there were as many as 8,000 socialists in Allegheny County, and there were three branches in McKeesport.
Were they Wobblies or Debs?
Wobblies were absolutely anathema to them.
Okay, so
the Wobblies,
they
were Debs socialists. These were the Eugene Victor Debs socialists.
Yeah.
Good story. In 1924, Debs came to Pittsburgh after he had been released from jail, having been put in jail for opposing World War I, and the Palmer Raids put him in jail. Came to Carnegie Music Hall, and my father took us there. There's an old streetcar track that came up through Frick Park with no streets, just two tracks. And he had Eugene Victor Debs kiss me, and he said, "You will live to be proud of this day," having been kissed by Eugene Victor Debs at the age of six. Eugene Victor Debs was a beautiful man, and basically not formally educated, but man of tremendous influence because of his success in organizing the railway workers into a strong union. Then he was succeeded basically by a number of people, including Norman Thomas.
Did you know him?
We knew him well. As a matter of fact, in 1930, my father drove him to a speech in Fairmont, West Virginia, and I sat in the back seat listening to my father explaining to poor, stupid Norman Thomas, the Protestant minister, how he was destroying the Socialist Party by playing into the hands of the communists, and warning Thomas that it was not going to be long before he destroyed the socialist movement. And by 1926, that had been accomplished. The Socialist Party, for all practical purposes, existence.
Well, no, wait a minute. They got a big vote in 32.
That's right. That was Thomas's vote.
Yeah.
There's no question.
A million
about it.
Votes.
That's all right, because I'm talking about the internecine warfare where the my dad was trying to tell him what a fool he was to believe that he could make music with the communists. By 1938, as a senior at the university, I wrote the history of the Socialist Party ending in 1936. And it's quite an interesting experience, because there were pockets of definite interest. Of course, the effectiveness of Franklin Delano Roosevelt's social programs helped to decimate the purposes for which the socialists thought they existed. In the meantime, though, there were elements that stayed intact because of the success of the democratic socialist movement in Norway, Denmark, Sweden, Holland, Switzerland, New Zealand, Australia, and then, of course, Histadrut in Israel. So that to this day, this democratic socialist movement exists at very high levels of government and international relations.
Peres is still a member, isn't he?
I'm sorry?
Peres, Israel.
Peretz, yeah, Peretz was one of them. But that was an interesting story when you go into Israel to realize the differences between the religious Zionists and the Jabotinsky groups and the democratic socialists. They were fighting for an ideal to this day, the Workman's Circle still sponsors teaching young people Hebrew and Yiddish and running Sunday schools in Cleveland and Detroit, Chicago, Los Angeles, Miami, Philadelphia, and New York. Still continuing to be, well, some of the strongest supporters of the State of Israel. Instead of supporting the promulgation of Yiddish, which incidentally is a story, my father absolutely insisted 40 years ago that this language would get stronger and stronger, and now we've salvaged 1 million volumes of Yiddish in Amherst, Massachusetts, and just as late as the spring of 1991, Aaron Lansky won the $225,000 MacArthur Prize, bought himself a minivan, and took 8,000 volumes of Yiddish on a boat to Poland, loaded the van, and went from small town in Russia, passing out Yiddish volumes.
What do you mean we? You said we.
We. I am still involved. I belong to YIVO and send them a check every month. The Workman's Circle, Bessie has pulled together, Bess Popolsky has pulled together 10 or 12 people who speak Yiddish every third Sunday at the JCC. Yiddish is being principally used by significant numbers of Russians coming to
Bessie. Can't read Yiddish?
I'm sorry, yeah, I use it for dramatic appeal. Learns that. Some people.
But they were set, Workman's Circle are secular socialists. Secular Democrats, socialists. How do you feel about that?
I think it's extremely important that this book, the eventual...
Not letting you get up.
Let the machine turn the goddamn thing
on. How do you turn it on?
I got it on.
Tell me.
This will take it off. And let it go by machine.
I think that the
how many times has it rang?
I'm sorry?
How many times has it rang?
Four times.
I wish I could turn this up and tell you a great story.
No. I don't want those stories. I want these stories.
I'll
turn it off.
About the Democratic Socialists. The future of American capitalism, in my opinion, turns on cooperation. If you want to go back in history, go back to 1843 to the Rochdale Principles started in a coal mining town in England called Rochdale, R-O-C-H-D-A-L-E, where these working people put together a co-op that was basically set up for one man, one vote. Everybody bought stock in the co-op. You got a dividend on your stock, but you gained your benefit by the amount of service that you bought from the co-op. One man, one vote. You could own 10,000 shares. I could own 50. We each had one vote. But you got your benefit from the dividends, the fact that you patronized the co-op more than I did. Now, I think it's important that when you stop to see what is going to happen in Eastern Europe, while we contend to teach them a free market economy, it is so fundamentally misguided, because when they finish, they will not have what we have, because we've got several hundred years and you can't wait to develop capitalism as poor Mr. Bush understands it. That the solution lies in cooperation, because here's a case where, with cooperatives, little people, economically little, can survive at a very high level by joint efforts. This, to me, is the essence of the democratic socialist concept. It would have room for free enterprise, as the Chinese have taken their land and turned it back to farmers, as the Russians are now breaking up the co-op. What the Russians did, what Lenin did, was destroy the whole concept of socialism by prostituting it and making it into a system of taking care of a few small people. My daughter went to China last year as a travel person, went to the biggest, newest hotel, and sat there at dinner and showed us a picture, and behind were a series of eight men dressed in mufti. And I said, Lori, who are those people? She said, those are the army generals who own that hotel.
Mm-hmm.
So in China, as in Russia, you have
a few big people.
A few people taking the system over just like the capitalists
yes.
do. But when you get the cooperation, that process does not exist. And why I say that the future of human civilization turns on cooperation. That you can be an Orthodox, you can be a conservative, I can be a non-believer, and we coexist. And this is one of the things you have to give the Histadrut credit for, that they attained hegemony in Israel before the religious Zionists could get control, and created a climate that gave room for the religious Zion, religious people to exist, which if the process had been reversed, you would have a Mea Shearim all over the country. Give me a second, please.
Yeah, sure.
As you pick up contemporaneous materials, we can come back to those later with
yeah.
questions that you
yeah.
ask me to specifically expand on.
No.
You can expand later on some of the personal experiences and let me describe to you what happened to some of these
people. I don't want to hear that yet.
Not now, but I'm sitting
yeah.
down
yes,
there.
Yes, you will.
Okay.
I've got to finish up with
Let's go back to the siblings.
When were your parents married?
They were married in 1914.
Where?
In the east side of New York.
Mm-hmm.
Both of them came out of Orthodox traditions,
mm-hmm.
and both of them revolted.
Why?
Basically, because they became free spirits. Don't forget, you sent kids overseas for 38 days on a goddamn rickety boat. You don't expect them to fall into some Orthodox setting. They found out that my mother particularly discovered that women have certain rights in this country that didn't exist in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And they certainly didn't exist in Orthodoxy. And she wasn't about to be party to that.
Mm-hmm.
My mother had six sisters and two brothers. They all ended up in this country. The oldest brother had two sons.
Did they ever have any religious participation after they became free spirits?
My mother and father never.
Never.
It was the only time my mother would go into a synagogue was to go up to Greensburg to listen to Perry Morrison sing.
That she did go on Rosh Hashanah.
Only because she wanted to hear Perry.
Oh, baloney.
Don't give me baloney. I sat there for 52 years and have never touched a book. What are you
mm-hmm.
talking about?
Mm-hmm.
In order to keep the peace with my wife. Don't
mm-hmm.
tell me. Baloney.
And your father?
My father wouldn't be caught dead in the synagogue, and yet when his funeral, seven rabbis came up to shake my hand and tell me how he had supported him. He was the real...
But he did support him.
Oh, my God. He was a real character in respect. Go out to the home for the aged.
Did you get any religious instruction at all?
No.
Can you read the alphabet?
No. None whatsoever. And all four of my grandchildren are fluent in Hebrew.
Mm-hmm.
I'm an anomaly, and I'm proud of it, because I created a home situation that gave my wife freedom to believe as she believed, and gave my children freedom to believe as they believed. In fact, my two daughters each married a Republican. Both are still they're still Democrat. The point is that I created a home situation that gave complete freedom to my children and my wife and now my grandchildren to believe as they wished, but just to listen and hear what I had to say. Don't agree with it.
Mm-hmm.
And this goes for the whole community. I'm totally out of step with most of the people, having had now 55 years of fundraising and federation, living with the conservatives, living with the rabbis.
So your parents never associated directly with the synagogues, either in New York or here.
No.
You got no
relatives. No.
The other children.
No. And my sister married a Jewish man, and both of their children were given the Reformed upbringing. Their grandchildren, with the older son, are being bar mitzvahed. My brother Carl married a Christian. Christian and have five Italian kids that don't have any religion, either Christian or Jewish. My brother Sidney married a Jewish girl from Cannonsburg. Shirley, they have two sons, the older one of whom married a non-Jew, but was married in a conservative synagogue in Washington, the younger one of which is not married yet. So
where
the three of us became Jewish people and stayed as Jews and took a responsibility in the Jewish community.
Yeah, I'm going to get you back to that. Where did you meet your wife, and were you married in the with a
married at the Red of Sholem? Yes. Oh,
so, yeah. Where did you meet your wife?
I met my wife at home with mutual friends. She had gone to Northwestern, and I tried to date her as a senior. Going through Chicago as the manager of debate at the University of Pittsburgh. She was busy, so I'd seen her in high school because she was a half a year ahead of me, but was in a Jewish milieu at the Road of Sholem, which excluded me because I came from Swissville and didn't belong to any religious space, and found my whole solace in the Jewish Community Center, where they didn't ask me what church I went to or what my religion was. So I have been a Jewish center person all my life. That made it comfortable for me to be Jewish. And incidentally, I found out in my 60s that all of the things that I believed were important happened to be Jewish. For instance, I never could make